What in God's name do you need a solvent for except to kill someone?
That's an outrageous slur.
Google it, mate.
The only way that you can preserve peace is to prepare for war.
Views on News with Mark Latham. Mark
Latham. Good morning, Mark Latham. How are you?
Good, thanks, Brent. Good to be talking to you.
Likewise, mate. Let's kick it off with Joe Biden. It's been rumoured, it's been written about a lot in the last couple of days that over this weekend, Joe Biden is going to announce that he's decided not to continue to run as candidate for the Democratic Party in the US elections November 5. So far, we haven't heard anything, but we've got some pretty powerful people now suggesting that that's what Biden do. For example, President Obama, who Joe Biden was his vice president. He's now come out and openly said he thinks that Joe should step aside. And we know we've heard leaders of the Democratic Party have now stood up and said that they think that Joe should set aside. As I said, no news yet. What's your thoughts? Will it happen?
Well, it's very hard to know from conflicting media reports. Yesterday, I looked at one US news service that said he was staying and was about to announce his new campaign commitments, and I flicked over to the other news service who said he was going. So it's very hard to tell, isn't it? You know, generally, Brent, in this situation, there are two types of politicians. One sort of faces up to reality and sees the writing on the wall and thinks, well, my time is up, I better just go gracefully. And the other type of politician starts to believe their own propaganda. And perhaps Biden is in that second category. There was a suggestion that on this Sunday he'd be dropping out, using COVID as an excuse that his health wasn't up to it. But we haven't seen that. What we do know is that there are 36 Democrat office holders, so that's governors, senators and congressmen who said that he should go, which is quite a substantial number. And then in the background, people like Barack Obama reported to have basically given up on Biden's chances of winning. So it's very hard to know. If he hangs on, then the Democrats have got a convention in a month's time in Chicago, and the rules of their party would indicate that to get rid of him, to take away all the primary delegates he's accumulated, they'd have to declare an open vote on the floor of the convention, which is Democratic, very exciting. You know, it'd be a thrilling moment to see if he renominated, if they were able to roll him, who would replace him. All of that lies in the future, but for the next 4 weeks, there'll be mounting speculation that Biden has to go. I suppose more Democrats will come out publicly. But if he hangs on, it's a month from now before they can get rid of him.
Mark, it seems at the moment the only two people that want him to stay is Joe Biden and his wife Jill.
Well, that might be right in terms of the emotion of it, but he has some other supporters. There'd also be the normal political mischief around the place. Kamala Harris, undoubtedly, the vice president, would be thinking, well, wouldn't it be good if he just resigned as president? She becomes president, the incumbent, and obviously the Democrat nominee. She'd be hoping for that, but in the way of politics, to say that to Joe Biden would probably mean he digs in deeper, becomes more stubborn. So it's a very, very difficult situation, unprecedented in the long history of American politics, that a serving president accumulated all the primary delegates. I mean, all these stupid Democrats didn't face the reality that mentally and physically he wasn't up to it. They allowed him to accumulate all the delegates, or just about all of them, for the primaries. And it's unprecedented that in one debate, what, 3 weeks ago, it was the obvious became plain to everyone that he wasn't up to it. And they're starting to mount different kinds of campaigns behind the scenes publicly to find a new candidate who can beat Donald Trump. So we've never seen anything like this. And where it lands, well, other than Joe Biden and his immediate family and advisors, nobody really knows.
Donald Trump's no longer going to face trial for mishandling classified documents. This came after a federal judge he appointed throughout the case, ruling that the prosecutor overseeing the charges was improperly appointed. And, of course, this comes days after his attempted assassination. He's gone on since that attempted assassination to, it seems as though, bigger and better things. I mean, the supporters have become more vocal. And, of course, he announced his vice president, J.D. Vance. Now, that's a turnaround in relationships, because J.D. Vance himself actually once referred to Trump as America's Hitler.
Yeah, he did, but he's admitted that he was wrong. And Trump must be a fairly forgiving sort of person for all the criticism and detractors who say that Trump is, you know, too harsh and too extreme. He's forgiven J.D. Vance for that extreme comment and now has him as the Republican vice presidential candidate. This is at the very successful Republican convention they've had over 4 days in Milwaukee in Wisconsin, one of the key swing states. So the Republican Party now is very much stamped with the Trump insignia. There was a long debate from the time of George W. Bush and his brother Jeb, who ran against Trump in 2016, what sort of Republican Party would they be? But they're now an intensely patriotic party, America first, not wanting to be involved in foreign wars, wanting to look after American manufacturing with some protectionism and the like, obviously pro-business. And J.D. Vance is sort of a mini-Trump in that regard, notwithstanding their past differences. And I think Trump, in making that selection, is basically saying this 39-year-old short-serving Ohio senator is the future of the Republican Party when Trump goes. And it's a slap in the face for all those who ran against him in the primaries. So anyone who ran against Trump, he didn't put them on the ticket as vice president. He's picked a bit of an outsider to the ticket and said J.D. Vance is the future of their party. So it's very much a Trump party now. It's not the party of the Bushes or any of the candidates, the sort of people we've had in the past as Republican presidential and vice presidential candidates. You might as well call it the Trump Republican Party, and that's what the convention showed. You know, Trump himself has said it was a love fest, and basically it was love of Donald Trump.
Now, speaking of the love and the forgiveness of Donald Trump, he's forgiven J.D. Vance for what he said. Maybe, just maybe, Mark, this means that Kevin Rudd may be okay. Kevin Rudd may keep his job as U.S. ambassador to the States. Of course, we have memories of Kevin Rudd being that angry little Kevin Rudd, for example.
Mate, this is just impossible. I get to the very end, I can tell it's in the embassy to just give me simple sentences. I mean, I've said this before. This language is just complicates it so much. How can anyone do this?
That's the Kevin we know and the Kevin that some love. So it seems as though there may be lots of love handed out, and Kevin might keep his job if Donald Trump wins the presidency. Because there was lots of talk after what Kevin said of Donald Trump, and I might add, he's not on his Pat Malone, that one of the first people on the plane back to Queensland after Donald Trump was to win the November 5 election would be Kevin Rudd.
Well, Kevin Rudd did describe Donald Trump as a traitor to the West and other harsh criticism. Will Trump forgive that? Well, ultimately, our ambassador in Washington's decided by the Albanese government, not by Donald Trump, but I still think Rudd would get a frosty reception if he turned up at the White House. But Rudd's out there in typical Kevin style on a publicity campaign at the Republican convention to make out he's their new best friend.
He is, yes.
So he knows no shame. He's got more front than Mark Foy's Kevin Rudd. So he turned up and made out he's sort of a born-again Trumpite. But, Brent, let's also recognise another reality. I think it's very unlikely that the Democrats will go forward with Joe Biden. I think it's also possible they won't have Kamala Harris. If they pick one of their fresh-faced Midwest governors as the Democrat candidate, it would be an entirely different race. Like, no one should think that this election is already wrapped up for Donald Trump, because you only have to listen to his 90-minute convention speech to know that, you know, he's quite old himself and his themes are a bit dated now. A fresh Democrat candidate coming in to say, let's forget the division and the rancor of Trump versus Clinton, Trump versus Biden. Let's have a whole new fresh start to unite the country. That would be a very powerful electoral message. So I still think Trump is a bit vulnerable in the election that's ultimately held in November. He's not a mile ahead in the polls, you know, in some of the key states. He's 3 points, 6 points ahead, which is, you know, not a huge margin. So Trump himself, you know, obviously out of the failed assassination attempt, their successful convention, Trump looks, he's got the momentum. But in American politics, things can change very quickly. They always talk about an October surprise. Maybe it'll be an August surprise where we get a very different Democrat nominee for president and a whole new race that could bring its own surprises. So a long way to go, and the biggest issue is not Kevin Rudd, it's who the Democrats are going to run.
Let me come back here and talk about preferred Prime Minister. In the polls, in one particular poll, I think it's the Sydney Morning Herald poll, the Resolve poll, it's the first time that Peter Dutton has come out on top as the preferred Prime Minister. Do you think this is a trend or a one-off?
Well, incumbents aren't going great. We saw that in Britain. And obviously Biden looks like he's finished in the United States. So, and in New Zealand, they got rid of the long-serving Labor government. It's unusual by Australian standards that Albanese would be voted out. Normally Australians give a new government a second chance. Well, Whitlam went out after 3 years, but he did win an election in the middle of that, was re-elected. So it's unusual that a new government in Australia wouldn't be re-elected and doesn't get a second chance. But the electoral mood at the moment is very punishing because of the cost of living crisis, the housing affordability crisis, the problems we have with electricity and energy costs, and a loss of faith in the promises of the Albanese government. We saw that in the Voice referendum. They promised a $275 reduction in electricity prices. It's gone the other way. Albanese looks flat and out of ideas for the country. Labor has some internal problems we've seen with Senator Payman and the CFMEU. So, yeah, Dutton, I think, is on the rise, but we're a long way to go. I was talking to someone yesterday about this. Albanese, I think, is a full-term Prime Minister. We won't have the election until March or May of next year. I don't think it'll be this year. So a long way to go, but, yeah, all the momentum and the polling at the moment is on Peter Dutton's side.
You mentioned the CFMEU. That was the big story, really, for the week. I see that Peter Dutton attacked the government's decision to appoint an independent administrator to take control of the CFMEU. He said that they should be deregistered. He said that that's exactly what Bob Hawke did with the BLF, the Builders Labourers Federation. He had the guts and the backbone to do it, and that Albanese doesn't have the guts or the backbones to do it. Lots been said and lots been written. I don't know. What's your thoughts, Mark?
Well, I think it's ridiculous for Labor, senior Labor figures to say, oh, they didn't really know much about what was going on inside the CFMEU. They've known exactly. The thuggery, the corruption, the associations with bikie gangs and organised crime. John Setka's certainly been no public secret. And they've tolerated it. Chris Minns and other premiers are happy to have the state branches of the CFMEU affiliated to their party, happy to have electoral donations that they're now not paying back, are happy to take the money, happy to take the delegates at Labor Party conferences. So people have known about this problem for a long, long while and done absolutely nothing about it. And it's been a very costly problem because the CFMEU add to building costs. I mean, part of the housing affordability crisis is this rogue union that's made it harder for construction companies to build things at an affordable price. The delays, the intimidation, the thuggery, the threats that companies get have added to their building costs. So, you know, it's been costly for the average Australian. It's not just an insider's political story. And Labor should be ashamed of the way in which they've tolerated this, turning a blind eye over a long period of time, you know. Brent, I can tell you my own encounter with this. 15 years ago, I went to a horse sale in Sydney where every second year weanling was being purchased by a CFMEU official, which was obviously money laundering. Why were these union officials there buying horses? So, which they would have then on-sold as money laundering. So, you know, these problems have been around for a long while. The construction industry is tough. It does require an effective trade union, but not one that's caught up with organised crime. It's been quite a disgrace.
All right. There was a story. I wanted to ask your thoughts on this. Coward attackers convicted of domestic violence assaults dodging prison time at alarming rates, despite the number of offenders dramatically rising over the last 5 years. Just 11%. The numbers were in, I think it was a Telegraph story over the weekend, 947 of 8,594 domestic violence offenders convicted of assault in 2023 were sentenced to serve time behind bars. That's only 947 of 8,500 actually were sentenced to serve time behind bars. That's according to the latest data from the New South Wales Bureau of Crime Statistics and Research. They're startling figures, aren't they, Mark?
Absolutely, and it goes to the guts of what I think is the hollowness, the sham of the domestic violence debate. I mean, the Daily Telegraph said, oh, we're going to call them coward attackers. I don't think labels and words in a newspaper make any difference to the rate of domestic violence out in the community. Politicians spend a lot of money on this. You know, we've all heard the rhetoric in recent months. But the basic truth comes down to some well-researched statistics, and that is that the best predictor of a domestic violence offender is someone who's been convicted of it in the past. So you want the repeat offenders to be jailed. Obviously, they're in jail. They can't be hitting their partner, their spouse, any other person out in the community. So you want to jail repeat offenders. But the jailing rate, the incarceration rate in domestic violence convictions is just 11% and dropping. Just 11% and dropping. So 9 out of 10 are still out there under very weak community service orders and the like, ankle bracelets that aren't effective and the like. So the softness in the law and order system is your main problem. So the same politicians, whether it's Mark Speakman, Chris Minns, or anyone else, Anthony Albanese, who've been talking about a strong approach on domestic violence, are weak when it comes to actually putting people in jail where they belong. So if you put them in jail, you'll automatically lower the rate of domestic violence in New South Wales and right across the country. It's a great paradox in this debate that the real thing that needs to be done is where our politicians are weakest.
Very true. We thought the world was coming to an end. Well, the tech world was coming to an end on Friday afternoon at about 3 o'clock. It affected this outage, affected millions and millions of people, and it was right across the world. Some of the pictures we saw in the 6 o'clock news services on Friday night, Mark, boy, oh boy, did this problem, this outage, this patch update that went wrong, it created absolute angst for so many, for millions of people.
Yeah, it looks like it's been targeted somehow at the transport system. The airlines are particularly affected. It hasn't affected my computers or phones, I've got to say. I think New South Wales Parliament House might have been affected a bit, but I read this morning 8.5 million computers worldwide went down, which is not a huge number, I'd imagine. There's many hundreds of millions of computers around the world, maybe billions. So 8.5 million is not a big number, but the inconvenience in the transport system, I saw in India the airlines were writing handwritten passenger boarding passes, and maybe that was happening elsewhere. So yeah, you affect the transport system. Obviously, it's a big problem. I see that they're fixing it now. But it's a reminder, Brent, of how vulnerable we are to the IT systems and companies that have a lot of power. It's little understood in Australia, for instance, that in terms of the IT system for freight in and out of Australia, there's a really big thing, all the freight and products that we move around, there's one company that has a virtual monopoly, and they're trying to get 90% of the global trade in that area. So without anyone really noticing, a lot of IT companies have accumulated enormous power for price gouging and possibly, you know, holding the world to ransom, you know, or a certain country to ransom almost. So, you know, I hope the ACCC has a look at this and see what can be done to ensure that no one IT company has too much power in one sector.
I see Bob Catt has come out over the weekend and said that the outage on Friday, here's a reason why cash must still be king.
Well, I suppose so. I know there's some people saying, oh, there's some global World Economic Forum conspiracy to have a cashless society, but 6% of transactions in Australia are still through cash, which is a big number. 94% with cards and other mechanisms, I suppose, a product of what happened during COVID. But 6% of people still use cash in various ways because it suits them. And I think as long as that's the case, we're going to have cash out there. But Bob's right. If the computer systems go down, cash becomes king again. Not 6%, but 100%. And although when I shopped at Woolworths on Friday in Camden, I've got to say you couldn't use the cash terminals. You had to have card only. So it was a bit of a mixed bag. But yeah, I think we'll always have cash.
Mark, look, I know it's a survey, but we've talked before about the word recession here, and politicians don't like that R word. In a recent survey, and this was taken in May and June, almost 1,400 Australians took part in the survey, 60% 60% of Australians believe we're in a recession, despite, you know, gross domestic profit figures and quarterly growth and politicians standing up there and telling us everything's, you know, doing okay because unemployment figures are fine. But 60% of Australians, that's the perception. And we know perception becomes truth.
Well, it feels that way for people. You know, not everyone reads the ABS data on economic growth or decline. And the real life experience at the moment is stubbornly high inflation, which is 4% and above. So people see the prices going up at Woolworths and Coles and elsewhere. And they don't see their wages going up as much, or they've lost their job. So it feels that the economy is flat. It is flat. You know, economic growth is very sluggish. It's certainly not booming along. So the economy is flat, and for your average Australian, the cost of living crisis feels like a real-life downer, a recession equivalent. So I don't blame people. I'm probably a bit surprised it's only 60%. I thought it might be a bit higher,
right,
because of the real-life economic experience that households are having.
Another research figure came back that 57%, that's 57% of small businesses across Australia in country towns are looking at closing their doors. That's terrible, isn't it? I mean, that will add millions to the unemployment lists. And I was saying it just doesn't stop there, though. I mean, most of those small businesses don't own the real estate that they rent, so it affects the landlord, it affects towns. I mean, you walk down a small country town's main street now and you see too many shops that are vacant. If this was to happen, I mean, goodness me.
You see it in the suburbs as well, and in that survey, I think the businesses were saying too much government red tape. And there are a lot of restrictions out there. Some of it are a hangover from COVID. Bureaucrats were empowered. And when you've got local councils that tell, say, a cafe, you can't have tables out on the footpath or you can't have them after a certain time of day, it's ridiculous. I mean, we've got to get rid of the red tape and restrictions on people trading, on people growing their business. And the hospitality sector in particular still suffers in New South Wales. So, yeah, I'm always urging that in the Parliament. Cut red tape, cut the restrictions, allow businesses to trade in a competitive market economy, and, you know, the good businesses will thrive. That's what we need. But, you know, the Labor government we've got at the moment, they don't do a lot on that front. And, yes, small businesses are going out the back door. Certainly when you talk to businesses that are involved in luxury or discretionary spending, say like the jewellery sector, they say they're doing it really, really tough and are hanging on by the skin of their teeth.
That's for sure. Let's talk about State of Origin. You would have watched the game on Wednesday night. What a game. What a game. What a result for New South Wales.
Yeah, that first half, it was 2-0 at halftime, so you didn't see any tries, but it was, for the rugby league devotee, a rugby league fan, it was the most amazing 40 minutes of football you'd ever see. The brutality of the tackling, the endurance and strength of these players. You know, like, I've watched rugby league for a long while now, and decades ago, yeah, there were great players, but now the athleticism, the size, the mobility of these players at the top level is just off the radar. And that was an amazing match in both halves. New South Wales got a few tries in the second half and won at Lang Park, which in itself was unusual. So yeah, an amazing game of football, and full credit to New South Wales for coming from 1-0 down. They had a player sent off early in the first game, so that probably wasn't a fair indicator. But New South Wales, definitely the superior team, and the strength and quality of those players, particularly the back rowers, was just amazing.
It was a good game, that's for sure. A very memorable game. And a surprise for a lot of people as well. I see a survey, no surprise here, I see a survey came out, I think it was Thursday or Friday, that I read somewhere, Mark, said that, you know, X amount of percentage of people, 62% or something of people surveyed, said that they, you know, they love the biff. They bring back the biff, as they used to say. They like a bit of a blue at State of Origin.
Well, it's passion that flows over, you know, spills over on the paddock. You know, that's just part of it, isn't it? You can't expect... I always like the saying where someone said, a contact sport, well, that's ballroom dancing. Rugby league is a collision sport. So you can't have 110-kilo monsters running into each other without a bit of passion and aggression spilling into the game. There was one that spilled over onto the sideline, and I don't blame the players on the bench who got involved. That's just a natural reaction, but they've been suspended for a fortnight or so. So, yeah, I think the fans do like the fact that, you know, a brutal game, and that's what it was, but also very skillful and athletic, gets a bit of passion and a bit of biffo And it's only State of Origin. You don't see this, obviously, on the weekend club games, but State of Origin special, and I think they should let the players, express all that passion and get stuck into it. That's my own view as a fan, I've got to say.
All right, Mark, thank you for your time as always. We'll leave it there. We always enjoy our chats. Have a great week. Stay warm if you can. Stay out of the wind, and we'll talk to you next Sunday.
Yeah, keep the roof on. That's the main thing.
It is.
All the best, Brent.
Thanks, Mark. See you, mate. Bye-bye. We'll talk next Sunday. That is Mark Latham.